Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Over the past decade, life in the military has changed in profound ways for women. The deployments of troops in Afghanistan and Iraq have exposed women to far more risk. Yet despite a loosening of restrictions against women in combat positions, through decree or reality, my guest today documents the bias and the complexity of a sexually integrated military. Journalist Helen Thorpe followed the stories of three female Indiana National Guardsmen who served a tour of duty in both in Afghanistan and Iraq in the last decade in her latest book, Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War. The book explains how three very different women from Indiana came into the Guard, how they negotiated a path in male-dominated units, and surmounted the bias towards women that is still part of military culture. Her three subjects experienced subtle and not so subtle sexism and job discrimination and show that strong performances in their roles can change the minds of their male colleagues. For those concerned about fraternization, those fears are confirmed, at least through the lives of these women, and the book also details the unique situations for female soldiers on the home front, while at home, as well as on deployment. Helen Thorpe is a writer who has written for the New York Observer, the New Yorker, and Texas Monthly. Her stories have also appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Slate, and Harper's Bazaar. Her first book, Just Like Us, documented the fate of three Hispanic Dream Act young women in Colorado. And she joins us today by phone on Studio Tulsa. Helen Thorpe, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Your latest book, Soldier Girls, follows three women from the Indiana National Guard. All three of them, I think, joined before 9/11 as a way of paying for school or in one case, just as something fun to do, I think, in the case of Debbie Helton. But they found themselves, like many National Guard units, pulling multiple tours in the Middle East through the last decade. How did you discover these three women?
I was interviewing different veterans who were returning from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I met this young woman. She's identified as Michelle Fisher in the book, which is not her real name. She chose to use a pseudonym. But she struck me right away as somebody who was so compelling because she's a great storyteller. She's very, very funny. She's a very unusual type of soldier. She had voted for Ralph Nader right before she enlisted in the National Guard. So, you know, her points of view are kind of out of sync with some of her other fellow veterans. She's a very strong individual, and she introduced me to her two close friends, and their views were really different from hers, and I loved the trio of women and how different they all were.
Well, let's talk about Michelle Fisher. She joined again before 9/11. It was a way to pay for college. She was poor, had a difficult upbringing, and was a very smart woman and wanted to go to college.
That's right. She was 18 when she enlisted, and it was the spring of 2001, and she had done 1 year of community college. And she really aspired to go to a four-year college and get a bachelor degree, and she wanted to be challenged at a great university, and she couldn't figure out how to pay for college. Her dad had been in and out of jail. He'd been married six times to four different women, and her mom was sometimes on welfare and sometimes doing factory jobs, but neither of them had set aside any money for college for her. So she needed to figure it out on her own, and what she figured out was she could join the National Guard and get college tuition.
And if I can stop you for a second, she was really smart. I mean, as far as like her college entrance exams, I mean, these were like scholarship-level performance.
Yeah, and I was puzzled by that. I asked her, I said, you know, if you were not keen to join the military, as she wasn't initially, couldn't you have gotten scholarships a different way if you were so conflicted about the decision? And she said, well, you know, there was nobody in my family who'd ever gone to college, and I just didn't know. I didn't know how to apply for scholarships. I didn't understand that they were widely available. There might have been a school for her if she'd had all the right advice, but on her own, she didn't figure it out. And then a year after graduating from high school, she remembered, you know, when she was thinking, how could I possibly pay for a full-time college experience for 4 years, she remembered the voices of the recruiters who'd come to her high school and ended up going to the National Guard to find out more.
And, of course, while she's, I believe, in basic, 9/11 occurs.
Yeah, so she actually had just finished basic training, and she was in the second part of her training, which was she was becoming a weapons mechanic. And she was at Aberdeen Proving Grounds, and she was actually in a class where She was the only woman in this class, and there were all the other men were either regular Army, Marines, or some were in the National Guard, as she was. And they were taking apart 9mm that morning when a drill sergeant burst into the classroom and explained that two airplanes had just hit the World Trade Center buildings and that the country was appeared to be under attack. That was how she learned of 9/11.
Well,
and she understood, you know, before that day was over, she understood that there was a great likelihood that things were going to be really different than she had envisioned. She thought she was signing up for a free ride to college and to go to drill, you know, once a month. But actually, she understood right away she might deploy. It could be really, really different than what she'd been thinking.
Now, talk about the other two women that you've focused on that you met through Michelle, as
Sure.
she's called in the book. The first is Debbie Helton, who's a very different case.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about Debbie Helton.
Well, what I loved about getting the chance to know these three women and to write about them is how different they were from each other. So Debbie is somebody who mothers Michelle after they become close while serving in the Guard together. And it doesn't happen right away because at first they're drilling in different locations, but after a few years, when they are deployed to Afghanistan and they're living at Camp Phoenix in Kabul, at that point, Debbie really adopts Michelle. She mothers her. She's 30 years older than Michelle. She had always wanted to join the military. Her dad had been in the Army. She wanted to follow in his footsteps. She had been a single mother when she first tried to enlist in the regular Army and was told she couldn't enlist as a single parent. And then later, when her daughter was a little bit older, she did enlist in the National Guard after giving custody of her daughter over to her own parents. And so this was really the fulfillment of a lifelong dream for Debbie. You know, her emotional response to joining the military was really different than that of Michelle, who was always a little bit at odds with the institution and a little bit at odds with some of her fellow soldiers. For Debbie, it was really an experience of finding a group where she felt she really belonged. She always thought of it as like the highlight of her life. Even the deployment to Afghanistan, which others found scary, she thought of as, you know, the most thrilling thing that ever happened to her.
And she actually had to work to get sent to Afghanistan. She
was going
to
be
left
behind. And she was beside herself. She thought, how can my unit go without me? You know, I really want to do something like this.
You know, when we think about the debate over women in combat and, you know, the changing regulations now, Debbie strikes me as one of those persons who probably would have wanted to be that way. She was a crack shot. She was actually an expert marksman.
Yeah. So the book follows these women over a 12-year period of time. And right at the very end of those 12 years, you see discussion in Washington around actually really doing away with almost all of the restrictions around what women are allowed to do in the military. And Debbie's first thought is, oh, I could have been a sniper if only these laws had been changed when I was young.
Given that attitude, through her first years in the Guard, what was her occupation? What did she actually do?
So she also chose to study weapons, but unlike Michelle, she wanted to study the big guns. So Michelle was a small weapons mechanic, you know, 9mm through the M16s. But for Debbie, she thought it was the word she used was romantic. She thought it was more romantic to work on the guns in a tank or to work on a howitzer, to work on, you know, the big guns that the Army was relying on. And an interesting thing happened about partway through her National Guard career, which was that a lot of those big guns ended up becoming the work that she had been trained to do. Those weapons became digitized, and computers took over doing the tasks that she had been trained to do. And her expertise, that job slot sort of went away. And at that point, then, she cross-trained to become a small weapons mechanic like Michelle, which is how they ended up in Afghanistan working side-by-side fixing broken AK-47s.
But when she was in Indiana,
yeah,
she was mainly running a hot dog wagon.
Yeah, exactly. That was how she was known to her fellow National Guard soldiers, because she's very, very gregarious. So one of the roles she filled was to work on the team that did
retention and morale.
Retention, and so she was essentially recruiting her fellow soldiers to stay in the Guard. And so she would touch base with everybody, see how they were doing. If their, you know, tour was up, she would try to convince them to enlist for another 6 years or however long they might be willing to sign up for. She was trying to retain the soldiers that they had to persuade them to stay in the Guard. And one of the ways they went about sort of creating a good morale and a good climate and persuading lots of people to stay in the Guard was by having this really top-notch snack truck, the hot dog trailer, as people called it, where they sold hot dogs and pop and Gatorade and chips and, you know, a variety of things, especially during their 2 weeks of annual training in the summer.
But it just seemed like it was such a mismatch, because here's two women who really didn't want to be there,
right.
This one woman who wanted to be here, and it was like she couldn't find a role.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know that they would have become such close friends if they had not deployed. But when they found themselves overseas, I think a lot of the differences that they had at home, the differences in age, the differences maybe in political outlook or their different feelings about the military, you know, where Debbie was so comfortable and Michelle was so at odds. When they found themselves over in Afghanistan, those differences they had felt so acutely at home kind of melted away over time. And what became kind of the common basis of their friendship was a shared love of learning more about a foreign country, a real interest in Afghanistan, a real interest in speaking to any Afghanis that they could meet. They had a shared sense of humor. They had a kind of a shared rebelliousness. There was a lot that they had in common in terms of how they got through the deployment, with a sense of humor, with resilience, by amusing each other, with warmth and friendship, that it just mattered a lot more in the end to them.
And a bit of insubordination, too, as well.
Yes. Yeah.
And speaking of that, let's talk about the third of the trio. This is Desma Brooks, who was a logistics specialist,
yes.
who apparently was a whiz at fixing computer equipment or navigational equipment,
yeah.
or phone systems. You know, they had a phone system in stateside where they were constantly getting off frequency and members couldn't talk together. And she,
yeah.
actually fixed all of the phones in a whole outfit, right. over a 23-hour period.
There was an encryption capacity with the radios, and if they weren't timed and synchronized perfectly, you would just hear gobbledygook as if you were the foreign enemy. So she was constantly tinkering with those radios to enable everybody to actually talk to each other.
Now, how did Desma Brooks get into the Guard? Because it just seems like it was an odd fit from the very beginning.
Desma is an amazing human being. Out of the three women, I think it's fair to say she may have had the toughest childhood. She grew up in a home where she describes her mom as being in bed a lot, and that sometimes they would go to the grocery store, but Desma would really do the grocery shopping, and she would cook the meals and bring them to her mom. There was some sort of incident in the home which Desma doesn't really ever want to talk about, where there might have been abuse. It's not clear, but she wound up in the foster care system. And so she grew up partly in the foster care system and then was placed back in her mother's home. She did not manage to finish high school. She got in a big argument with the principal, threw her books at him, quit school, decided she was going to just support herself, and quickly learned that without a high school degree, it's very hard to get a job. And she wound up becoming pregnant at 16, but then going on to get her GED. She is, like Michelle, she's terrifically smart, but it's been very hard for her to, you know, follow the normal path into college. And so she, after she drops out of high school, gets her GED, a friend dares her to come along and see if she can join the National Guard. And Desna's thinking, well, I don't have anything better to do, you know, and she sort of makes a joke out of it, like she never really meant to join the Guard. It's a kind of a well-rehearsed story. She likes to tell her story of joining the Guard that way. And yet it's also true that once she does join the Guard, it becomes the one thing she really sticks to. You know, she'll admit sometimes that she feels badly about dropping out of high school, but she feels very proud that she stuck with the Guard and that she managed to do her deployment. So it becomes something over time that really gives her a sense of pride in herself.
And yet she's pretty insubordinate as far as military personnel goes.
She is. And in fact, at one point in the book, Michelle is warned by her superior to stay away from that woman, Brooks, because she's trouble. Which Michelle, not fitting in well in the military, she sort of is intrigued by this. And so Desma is, as you mentioned, she's a whiz with gadgets and with technology. She's getting great letters of commendation. She's actually even getting awards and things for the work that she does. But she's always partying a little bit more and having a little bit more fun and getting in a little bit more trouble than the average National Guard soldier. So, yeah. Fair to say she's insubordinate. I think she would agree.
My guest today is journalist Helen Thorpe. Her latest book is titled Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War. And this is the other thing is after 9/11, a lot of National Guard units were called up. They sat around for an awful long time, whether they're going to be deploy or not deploy. And these women were caught up in that as well.
Yeah. And we were just speaking about Desma, and for her, getting caught up in the deployments was a huge life matter because she's a single mom with three kids by the time the first deployment comes along.
Yeah. You began to see that sense of, you know, they're training, they're doing lots of training, and they're actually being called up, but they're still in the United States. And you just see this, I guess, a sense of boredom that punctuates a lot of these support jobs. Work.
Yeah, when they are deployed. At the point when they are deployed, women in their National Guard unit, because they're in a support battalion that is supporting infantry soldiers, they are, in essence, it's intended that they be a little bit on the sidelines of where the real action is supposed to be. Although in the kinds of wars that the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were, with roadside bombs going off and IEDs and RPGs being fired, you can't really tell where the explosion's going to be. So really keeping soldiers safe, it's you do the best you can, but even somebody in a supposedly safe support position, if they're over there in a war zone, they're still at risk of, you know, having a bomb come their way or being in a truck that hits a landmine. So they don't feel completely safe, and yet they also know that the infantry soldiers they support have much more dangerous jobs. And their first deployment to Afghanistan, Desma spends almost all her time on the post, whereas Michelle and Debbie, because they're fixing these AK-47s that the Afghan National Army is going to use, they actually leave the post to go do their work, which is relatively unusual among, you know, the other soldiers in their support battalion. Generally, the support battalion is largely staying on post.
And so they get to actually see a bit of Afghanistan and actually befriend translators and things like that.
That's right. They become very close to one particular translator who's highly educated and speaks a number of languages and is very eloquent and kind of explains Afghanistan to them and makes it really seem like a very magical place that they sort of fall in love with.
Yeah. Now, for the most part, though, for these support occupations, it seems like it's, you know, moments of being scared and a lot of time of just boredom.
Yeah, and I think these jobs, the support positions are often not the ones that are featured in movies or books, and so it's a little bit less what you see, you know, that like the Hollywood version of a soldier is probably more likely to be the infantry soldier or the special ops soldier, who's out doing a mission in a really dangerous situation. Whereas if we take Desma, for example, you know, her job was tracking the maintenance done at the motor pool and making sure that they always knew which trucks had been through their maintenance checks and which trucks were ready to go and had all the parts that they needed or what parts needed to be ordered. You know, her job was essential to the running of all the missions that were going off the post. Yet she herself, you know, spent almost her entire time in Afghanistan on the post.
Yeah. Now, they deployed to Afghanistan in 2004 and 2005 and then came back home to Indiana for 2 years. Yeah. What was the effect of that deployment on their lives?
You know, I think they were all surprised to find the transition home challenging because they understood themselves to have had, relatively speaking, relatively easy deployments compared to how hard some other people had it. So when they came home, they hadn't anticipated struggling to the extent that they did. And because they formed these really close friendships in Afghanistan, they were able to, you know, pick up the phone and call each other or text each other constantly and sort of talk each other through the transition back home. And I think a lot of the reason that they did well had to do with the fact that they weren't too isolated, they weren't too alone with the struggle. But I think they each found it very strange. You know, so Michelle, for example, came home, found herself very angry a lot of the time as members of her family or friends would ask about her deployment, and they couldn't keep straight had she been in Afghanistan or Iraq. You know, they would say, "Where were you?" She would say, "Kabul," and they wouldn't know which country that was, and she was frustrated with their lack of knowledge about what was going on overseas when she had just been over there. And then
it seems like I remember a scene where she's visiting a Walmart or something like that, and she's just like overwhelmed by, you know, and I think it's that whole idea of, you know, here's what you have right here on a base. And all of a sudden she's just overwhelmed by the choices.
Yeah, she's standing in the toilet paper aisle at Target when she has a really brutal panic attack, and it comes on because she's surrounded by all of these consumer goods, and for the last year she's been on a military base where things are very regimented. There's a very limited number of choices that she has to make, and if she goes to the PX to buy a certain item like potato chips, there'll just be one brand. She doesn't have to make a big choice around which type a consumer item to buy. But here she is at Target, and suddenly there's this plethora of stuff, and she can't figure out, is this toilet paper better than that one? And it just becomes, it's overstimulating and overwhelming, and suddenly it all crashes down on her, and she has this panic attack where she can't move, and she's crying, and her ex-boyfriend who's there with her, their relationship really, the deployment broke their relationship apart. But he is still supporting her and sort of helping her through this moment. He has to usher her out into the parking lot and get her out of there. And it's when she's outside in fresh air and sunlight and she starts to calm down. But she's puzzling over this, like, well, I didn't have a hard deployment. Why am I having a panic attack? And then, you know, when she calls and talks to Desma, Desma's explaining to her, well, I came home and there's my three kids, and I don't know what to feed them, and there's no food in the refrigerator, and the laundry's mounding up, and I go to the grocery store, and it was at the grocery store where Desma had a panic attack. And so they're having very similar experiences. I think it's very comforting for them to have a relationship with a fellow soldier who's going through similar transition back home. So they start to understand that these experiences that feel highly unusual to them are actually normal, as each of them is having the same kind of difficulty. It just takes a little bit of time, and they settle back in.
My guest today is Helen Thorpe. Her new book is titled Soldier Girls, The Battle of Three Women at Home and at War. It's published by Scribner. Of course, they spend 2 years home, and then they're deployed to Iraq.
Right.
And in this case, this was dangerous. Desma Brooks actually hit an IED.
Yeah, the deployment to Iraq was much harder and especially in Desma's case, much more dangerous. So when the deployment to Iraq comes, Michelle, her 6 years that she signed up for in the Guard have just come to an end. And she gets out of the Guard, and it's about just a matter of weeks, maybe 2 weeks later, that her whole unit gets orders saying, you're going to be going to Iraq. And she had been so looking forward to getting out of the Guard, but as soon as she hears that everybody she knows is going to be in Iraq, she feels terrible that they have to endure this and she doesn't, and she almost wishes that she was going with them. Their Guard unit, when they went to Iraq in 2008, was actually broken up and distributed across the brigade that they're part of anywhere that the Army needed personnel, and so they were no longer serving together. So Debbie, for example, wound up in Mosul, almost in a secretary-like position, working with officers in a headquarters. She was in a relatively safe situation as a result, but cut off from everybody that she knew and had been serving with previously. Desma was first transferred into a previously all-male infantry unit, which was being deployed not in an infantry capacity, but in a support capacity. So women were allowed to join. Because of the way in which they were being deployed, they were going to be doing convoy security. But she actually found the experience of joining that unit so uncomfortable because the men were so disturbed at the idea of women joining their unit, they were very unfriendly, that she requested a transfer into a different unit. It had also been previously all male, but it was friendly toward the few women who had joined. So she thought it would be a better unit to be in. Happened, it was a field artillery unit. So she's with a group of men in Iraq who've never served with women before, but she finds a unit where she feels comfortable and feels welcomed. But she's doing a far more dangerous job, convoy security.
No. And this is the other sense of how men and women related in combat areas. There were incidents. I think Debbie Helton said, while nothing happened to her, she said, you better lock the door if you shower at night because I got assaulted. And
yeah.
These things were happening. And you, Michelle Fisher, in her deployment, it was like men were hounding her, literally hounding her day and night.
Right. Yeah. I read a number of books as I was working on my book. And when I read books that had been were written about female soldiers or about women in the military or even by women in the military, I found that this was a very common experience that women just drew tons of attention because they're in a relative minority, so they're kind of unusual, or maybe the men view them even as a scarce commodity that they're fighting over. I think the women would say about their time in Afghanistan in 2004 that because they were in a mixed gender unit that was used to having women, they felt relatively safe with their own colleagues. You know, they didn't experience personally, none of them reported being assaulted, but they were getting all of this attention all the time in a way that actually made them uncomfortable. Then with DESMA, you know, 4 years later, being transferred into units that had previously been all male, I think there were really serious challenges. And she was grateful to find one unit where she felt really welcomed and really at home. And I think she made lifelong friendships with some of the men in that unit. So it's not as though you can say every all-male unit was hostile to women. It really varied. It depended a lot on the leadership or how the individual men chose to respond to that situation.
Well, how are these women doing today?
So as you mentioned, DESMA, while doing convoy security, hit a roadside bomb, and she did come home with a mild case of traumatic brain injury and PTSD. So she struggled the most coming back from the second deployment. But all three of the women are doing really well today. And even DESMA, who I think had to really work at relaxing, she became very hypervigilant after hitting the roadside bomb. For example, she would be uncomfortable sitting in a restaurant if she couldn't see the door. The idea of people walking up behind her made her very fearful. But she did find an excellent therapist at the VA who really helped her regain a sense of normalcy. And she's doing really well and moving forward.
Helen Thorpe, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Journalist Helen Thorpe speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her new book is titled Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War. It's published by Scribner. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.